Okay, so we continue now. We finished the last lecture by my explanation that the professional version of Enzyme, which is one that you do not have, allows you to give the values, the curves that should be reproduced by your model, by your simulation model, and then Benzene can calibrate the model for you, meaning finding the best values for the parameters so that you get a quite close fit to the empirical results. That is, if the model is good. If you have a very bad model, it will never be able to do that. So the model should be good in the sense that it is adequate for the purpose, and then Benzene Professional can do the job for you. This is something that you will not be able to do with the gratis, the free model, free tool that you have, the Benzene PLE, but it is important for your professional life to know what a powerful system can do. So we finished that, and then for today, the last topic that I put is the Hartley-Stahl slide. And I am going to spend the last hour showing you a system dynamics model that describes how a disaster was managed. And it is a landslide that occurred in Bergen, in the area of Hartlestad, which is a suburb of Bergen. Why do I do that? Well, because you are taking a master. The master is in information security, and then you will be looking for jobs. And it will be good if you know that many of the things that you learn in information security allow you also to start working in other areas, because the question of crisis and disasters and so on has many commonalities. After you finish, you will apply for jobs and you will have to be trained in the new job. No matter how much you have learned here, what you learn is methods, some experience, some attitude, an ability to identify problems, conceptualize them, solve them. But in professional life, you will have to learn more and adapt to the situation. And one of the areas where you may have an opportunity is in related areas. And there are many things that are common. In fact, if you look at the way the challenges of knowing are defined, then the Directorate for Civil Protection, which is called DSB in Norwegian, Directorate for Samfunnssikkerhet og Beredskap, Directorate of Civil Protection, they publish every year a report which they call the Nasjonalt Risikobilde of the year. The last one is Nasjonalt Risikobilde 2014. And that's a description of the risks that Norway is facing and the probability that they may occur and description of scenarios. If you went to that in the ESB and downloading the report, assuming you can Norwegian, then you get this report. And there you will see that they argue about a number of scenarios that can hit Norway. One of them is floods, but it's only one of them. It's well illustrated with pictures. And in fact, you see the scenarios are related to extreme weather, with several cases, to flooding, to landslides. Look, point number 62, scenario quick late skret ED, which in English means the scenario quick lay slide happening in a city. We will come back to that. Then you have about epidemics, you have about forest fires, you have about solar storm, which will actually hit all communications and break the dam. That will be the worst cyber angrep that could happen, that could be caused by the sun. You can have a volcano explosion in Iceland that will impair Norway as well. You can have earthquake, yes, earthquake. Yourself, NUT, earthquake NUT, that's a new identified risk. The probability for an earthquake in Norway is not so low as people believe. And if an earthquake of magnitude 6 happens in a big city like Oslo, Bergen or Trondheim, that's going to be a very, very, very bad event because Norwegian housing and buildings, they are not adapted to earthquakes. And other scenarios that are here, including terror attacks. And you see also issues like the digital scenario, cyber attack against financial infrastructure, cyber attack against communication infrastructure and so on. So this report is very, very interesting for you. And again, what you learn here in information security has bearing for many other possible disasters. So you may apply later for positions that are in other areas related to disasters, catastrophes and so on. Okay, or security. In fact, the word security in defined for European Union is not only information security, it's also about protection of life and of assets against all kind of risk, both natural catastrophes and man-made. Okay, so after this introduction, I go now to the lecture. So this is a study that I directed, first with two students. We created a simulation model 3 years ago with two master students. And then I published a paper, and then we extended the study, as I will explain now. And what kind of insights do we get from such a simulation model of a landslide disaster? So who cares and why? Well, large-scale disasters, and that means also if they have to do with information security, they are mostly very poorly managed. Okay, I have to go back. There is an old wisdom recognized by two distinguished American experts, Dines and Carantelli, as far back as 1976. The management of disasters demands that the organization becomes an emergent organization, which will accommodate new group of peoples that are able to self-organize themselves to deal with novel kind of tasks and able to handle this organization. That's because disasters disrupt the plans. You get perhaps half of the people you have prepared for. New people are there, perhaps from other organizations. The challenges, disasters do not follow scripts, so the challenge will always be new. So you have to adapt to them. And the whole process will be first disorganized, and you have to get organized in the middle of a big, big disruption. So this was recognized and documented by Dines and Carantelli by studying how disasters were managed in the past. But if you look today, 2012, there's a study, and there's the reference by Paltola and several other authors. Still today, the disaster response organizations tend to follow protocols for normal situations. That is, they train and have scripts, do this, do that. And when a disaster happens, then they follow the protocols that they have learned, even if the disaster is completely new in many aspects, and also the resources that you have are disrupted and so on. So we need a better understanding of what happens in large-scale disasters. First, there is a disequilibrium situation. The disaster causes a state of disruption and disequilibrium that disrupts the plans, disrupts the groups, the teams, creates new situations that you had never seen before and so on. That requires that the teams responding to some extent must improvise and even experiment with solutions, learn from them, until they emerge as a self-organized team that can handle the disaster better. That happens in all disasters. Okay, so which is the case we are going to study? That is the slide that happened in Bergen in the area of Hartlestad, the 14th of September in 2005, where 10 people were buried, 7 wounded, and 225 were evacuated. And that's how the disaster looked like. In the corner below, you see the landslide hitting the row of houses, which because of the danger that the landslide will, a new landslide will come, led to the evacuation of all the houses. And as I said, it destroyed several houses. 10 people were buried, 7 could be rescued, 3 died. And then you see a picture of what happened before. Bergen, which is a city famous for its rain, got more rain in that day than never before. Well, it was an outlier of Katrina. You have heard of Katrina. Katrina was a big hurricane that hit New Orleans and basically flooded the whole of New Orleans. Extreme weather event. And that happened about 10 days before. But the patterns of meteorology are like this. Here you see a picture of how the hurricane that hit New Orleans in the left, how that over time propagated and hit Norway. So that's typically how weather happens. You have a disruption somewhere and then it moves and affects something else. So when it came to Bergen, it caused as much rain as never before, and that much rain provoked a landslide of catastrophic dimensions. This landslide was agenda setting. That's a term introduced by Boyne, a Dutch expert in disaster management. Agenda setting means it changes the way, it creates a new agenda, and it changes the way the things are handled. In fact, it was not only the hard landslide, because some weeks later more landslides happened and they had disruptions and so on. They got a wide media coverage, there was strong public impact. It showed that in Norway there were unsatisfactory building policies, that is, one had built houses in areas that were risky for extreme weather and for landslides, and that led to policy changes and also to mapping, to finding out other sites that could be exposed. Now, Norway is, and perhaps that's a surprise for most of you, Norway is has an Achilles heel because of the problem known as quicklay. Quicklay is related to deposits of clay that happen under seawater for millions and millions of millions of years. And that is happen in connection with the ice ages and affects many countries in the north of the world, like Canada, is Russia as well, Sweden, Finland, United States, northern part of the United States, and Norway. What is so tricky with these clays is that they are stable if there's enough salt in them, as it comes from the time where they were maritime. But over time, because of rain, over thousands and thousands and thousands of years, the salt is being washed away, and then the clay becomes unstable. It looks stable enough. You can have houses in that, you can have bridges in that, you can have a lot of things on that. But if some forces occur that are shear forces are forces that apply from the side, then the clay can start moving. And then the terrible thing that happens is that these deposits of clay, when they move, they become kind of liquid. Instead of being a solid thing, they suddenly change the properties and they become liquid, and then they move away and take with them houses and whatever. And there have been many catastrophes like this before. So if you look in Wikipedia, under the other link here, quicklay rescued in Norway, quicklay landslide in Norway, they are documented as early as 2054, and probably have happened before in Berkshire, and they happened again in the 19th century twice. It happened in Buvika in the 18th, 19th century, and some of them destroyed a lot, and they have been happening with some regularity. The worst was in Verdal in 1893, where 55 million cubic meters schleidet, killing 116 people. Now, there have been happening more and more and more, and there is a strong concern about quickly landslide in Norway, because some cities, including Trondheim, have many buildings on quicklay. And in fact, if you look at the national risiko build here, and you look at the scenario that I mentioned before, 6.2, I think it was, quicklay risk rating B, which is page 62. Let's find that. Yes, I think that is. The area called Berglande in Trondheim, which is quite close to the Norwegian Technical University, in a hill, there are many houses in that, and there is concern that this could slide away. In addition to all the houses and the people that live there, the landslide will be so big that we will close the river, Nidelven, that goes and get it to rise by 12 meters, and it will flood the city of Trondheim, the center, the old area. That will be a tremendous catastrophe. And the bad news is this is going to happen, because it is quicklay, and it is becoming less and less salty, and sooner or later this can happen. Unless a solution is found, but at the moment we don't have a solution. It could take, it could happen tomorrow. Well, tomorrow, bad weather is not announced. It could happen next year, or this year, this autumn. It could happen in 10 years from now, in 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now. We don't know exactly, but it will happen sooner or later. And therefore, because of, and this is not the only area in Norway, because of that, there is great concern about that. I recommend to you that you go to this link, which I will publish for you, which shows a video of the quicklay landslide at Risa that happened in 1978. There you have an explanation of what happened, and you have photographs and so on. I will just, it takes about 20 minutes, so I am going to play just the beginning. You mean big here?
Deposits of marine clay in Norway cover a total area of 40,000 square kilometers.
40,000 square kilometers.
Quick clay slides represent a serious problem involving potential loss of lives and property. This documentary film presents the story of such a landslide. It contains unique pictures taken by two amateur photographers who happen to be at the scene. During the last glaciation, the northern hemisphere was more or less entirely covered by glaciers. In Scandinavia, the weight of an approximately 3,000 meter thick ice cap loaded the bedrock. During deglaciation, the sea transgressed in front of the retreating ice. About 11,000 years ago, the coasts of Norway were submitted to conditions similar to those in Spitsbergen and Greenland today. Melting water from the glaciers brought large amounts of suspended material into the fjords, where silt and clay were sedimented in the marine environment. Due to isostatic land uplift following the withdrawal of the glaciers, marine clay deposits rose above the water level. Such marine areas are shown with light green color on the map, and can today be found up to surface elevations of 200 meters above present sea level. In Norway and Sweden, such areas constitute the best farming land and are among the most heavily populated areas. The bedrock surface is very undulated with outcropping hills and valleys filled to some extent with marine sediments. Rain and surface water subject the marine clay surface to erosion. With time, the top 5 meters have altered to a weathered crust of stiff fissured clay. At the same time, an upward flow of fresh groundwater from fissures in bedrock and through sand layers gradually leaches the salt out of the pore water of the marine sediments. In its natural undisturbed state, quicklay exhibits considerable strength. However, if the load becomes too heavy, as shown in this example, a failure takes place as the clay particle structure collapses, followed by remolding of the clay. The most characteristic feature of a quicklay is the complete and drastic change of consistency by remolding. Such extreme quicklay behavior is encountered only when the salt concentration in the pore water drops below 1 gram per liter. To illustrate the important role of salt on the material properties, we can add a little ordinary table salt to the clay sample. When the salt goes back into the pore water, the salt ions alter the interaction between the minerals and the pore water. The remolded strength increases dramatically, and the clay is no longer a liquid.
Okay. I stop that now. As you can see, this is very interesting, and I leave it to you to learn. Now I continue with the lecture. Now I think you are quite motivated to understand this here. So this catastrophe was very well documented by a student that was his master study in Bergen. Now he is doing his doctorate in Bergen. His name is Peter Lango. He wrote about that in Norwegian. So unfortunately, because it's so interesting, it should have been published in English. He gave the time slide of the landslide. It happened at 1 o'clock in the morning of the 14th of September after heavy precipitation. And it lasted for about 11 hours, in the meaning that the rescuers came and they worked for about 11 hours to find out what to do to rescue the people that were submerged by this landslide, to find the people that were killed, free and so on, to evacuate the people and so on and so on. So all this is very well documented in the paper by Lango in the master thesis and in the chapter in the book, and we use that to develop a first initial simulation model. I call it a preliminary system dynamics model based on Lango's documentation. The problem is that his documentation, even if it was very extensive, it gave only hints as to the behavior over time of crucial variables. If you want to create a simulation, then you need to make the simulation so that your simulated variables come quite close to the observed values. But as I said, the documentation as to the values of important variables was a bit sketchy, so therefore our first initial model was preliminary. What I did was to take a previous work by a group of Chinese that were published in 2009. They had simulated what happened in vessel Palau of the US Navy that was entering the Bay of San Francisco and suddenly lost electric power, and therefore the navigation system didn't work. So the crew had to navigate in the Bay Area, which is a tricky area with very strong currents, based on new methods that they had to invent, like estimating distance by sight, controlling the distance, trying to ascertain the ship's position by observing positions in the map, and so all the things that are done by GPS now suddenly they had to do without any such assistance. So that was an incident. It didn't become a disaster because the disorganization that occurred by the incident, leading to some improvisation, resulted in a well-working team that in a self-organized and was able to master the situation after some disruption. The first thing we did was that I asked the master students to reproduce the Palau model. And we discovered, I directed the system dynamics modeling. We discovered that the model by two et al., which was published in a very renowned journal, had errors. And it was a very, very complicated model. So we corrected it, and we made a model that was much smaller and simpler, and then published the work. But again, our model assumed the behavior of the crucial variables based on very little details that were in Lango's paper. There was a long description of what happened, who, and so on, but as to the things that we needed to know, what happened over time, you had only some indications. So what we did this time was that we engaged Peter Lango, and he approached the respondent of the Hostelstad disaster, that is the police in Bergen. Hordaland is the area around Bergen. So the Hordaland police district in the center of Bergen, and in Bergen South, they were involved with the role of emergency management, steering, coordinating what to do. The civil defense was involved, and the municipality of Bergen was involved to evacuate the people. So he conducted interviews with them last year, of course 9 years after the event, so their memory was a bit fade. And we got some graphs for the behavior over time of crucial variables. In addition, we had some important results from these interviews. They confirm that because of the stress in handling the disaster, many errors were provoked, both in the way the tasks were executed and in the decisions taken. Also, they reported that there was a very high increase of workload, simply because the disaster create conditions that you have never seen before. They do not follow scripts. And the established procedures before the event very often are not suitable, and therefore the workload of the responders increases significantly about the expected normal workload. They needed to improvise response actions because those before undefined procedures were not sufficient or suitable. And because of the improvisation, misunderstanding happened easily with other staff and other teams involved in the emergency, which created errors. And they make this create most misunderstanding, problems, conflicts, and errors, and so on. So we asked them to sketch the behavior of the different variables, and since we didn't have exact data, we used the best thing that you can do, that's simply what they would assume that happened from memory. Of course, this introduces quite inaccurate curves. They are not as accurate as if you could measure them exactly, and also that happened 9 years ago. But as we say in system dynamics, it's better to be approximately correct than exactly wrong. You will be exactly wrong if you said, I don't have good data, therefore I don't consider the good load, I don't consider the cognitive load, I don't consider the improvisations and so on. I make a model with all these things, which means you are giving them a value, a very exact value. You are giving them value zero, which is the worst you could do. Therefore, it's better to be approximately correct than exactly wrong. Now, we created this simulation model here. This is the system dynamic model that we created. As you can see, it is relatively simple. It has five stocks, one about the workload, one about the cognitive load, which is kind of the stress on the people. The other is as to the work rate improvement, as it happens over time. It can be negative improvement, that is worse, about the mutual understanding, the understanding between the teams, and then the errors created by mismatch, by difficulties in communication. And you see there several feedback loops. You see a balancing loop, performance adjustment, which is this one. You see another feedback loop, learning, which is this one. You see a reinforcing loop, which is cognitive load leads to errors. And there should be one more, which I don't have here, which is mismatch create also errors. So I need to put that in the next version. So we tested the model. In addition to calibrating it, we conducted sensitivity tests, as you see on the left-hand side, and extreme tests. The sensitivity tests are important because if it turns out that a little change in some parameter makes very strong changes in the simulation of others, then this is problematic. You have a model that is not very stable. Or else, you will have to measure those parameters very, very accurately so as to have the exact value, which in this case is impossible because we have a high degree of inaccuracy in those curves, those graphs that the responders draw by hand according to memory. And in fact, they are qualitative because they don't have numbers. You can only compare low values with high values and so on. We discovered that the model was not very sensitive, which is a good thing. And then the model should not only reproduce their known scenario, it should also reproduce other scenarios that you can create and where you can say in advance what is going to happen. For instance, if there is no emergency, your model should behave as such. If your model still creates responses and stress and workload, even if there is no emergency, then that's a bad model. So you have to see if the model behaves as it should in extreme cases. You can also say what happens if it takes a long, long time, extremely long, to get rid of the stress cause. Then you could then deduce if the people are under stress for a long, long time, then they will be making mistakes during the whole handling of the disaster. So that's a predicted outcome that is easy to predict, and you can check if your model behaves like this. So all these extreme tests, they are necessary so that you get trust on the model. If the model, it is not enough to create a model that reproduces the observed behavior, because you can easily do that. If you have a model with hundreds and hundreds of parameters, and you let VenSim calibrate that, then you will be able to calibrate that. But the model will be worthless because it is created uniquely as a curve-fitting model, and it doesn't really give insight and it doesn't explain other situations. As the saying goes, if you have enough parameters, you can curve-fit an elephant. But that's not very illustrative and doesn't provide insights. Okay, then we simulated, and these curves should be compared with the undrawn by hand. And so you have to go a few slides behind, but I can tell you that they are qualitatively very similar to what the responder told us that it will be. So the workload was increased sharply and then decreased as the people are handling the situation. The cognitive load, the stress, will increase sharply for the first hours, then again as the improvisations are being better and better and people are learning, their stress decreases. The improvisation was very, very strong in the very beginning. The outcome on the cognitive load is because of the delays, it takes time to recover. Then mismatch of understanding, that is errors due to problems of communication, they increase with improvisation and then decay with learning and so on. And there were two more things, like the errors from cognitive pressure and errors from this mismatch. They also, the bigger the pressure on cognition, the more errors that were made, and similarly, the more the improvisation was done, there's the more errors because of miscommunication. Okay? So all this is quite convincing, in a sense, for the model. Now, let's try to understand what happens. As we did yesterday, when I said create a causal diagram, in this case it had two feedback loops, so it was an archetype, so as to communicate the insights of the Morrison model. Here we have a causal diagram that simplifies the system dynamic model and that contains the four important loops. And what we do is we look at the weight of the loops. And this you can do by feedback loop analysis. In the model, simply you can switch off the loops by putting conditions so that they are broken. And we see that the beginning of the simulation is explained by this balancing feedback loop, which is performing adjustment. There is an increase in the workload. Because of the increase in the workload, the cognitive load increases. Because of the cognitive load increases, people have to improvise to deal with new situation. That increases the work rate. By increasing the work rate, then you could in principle decrease the workload. But very quickly you get problems because this reinforcing loop is triggered. This reinforcing loop, the workload increases the cognitive load, which means that increases errors from cognitive pressure, which because of the mistakes induce rework and more workload. So here you have a reinforcing loop, loop that quite quickly becomes strong and becomes stronger than the performance adjustment, and it's leading to an increase in the workload because of the errors coming from stress, from cognitive pressure. And then, because you are improvising, this decreases the mutual understanding. Because the mutual understanding decreases, there is more mismatch. Because there is more mismatch, that means people think and act differently or have different mental models. Errors occur, and these errors increase the workload, which increases the cognitive load, which leads to even more improvisations, which decreases the mutual understanding and so on. So you have a reinforcing loop, communication mismatch leads to errors. So you have two kind of errors that are being reinforced in a vicious circle, from the errors from stress, from cognitive pressure, and the errors because progress in communication due to the improvisation. But then, gradually, people learn from the experiences. So they correct the errors, they improve the mutual understanding, they reduce the mismatch, they reduce the number of errors, and because the errors are corrected, they improve the misunderstanding. So this learning here will sooner or later reverse the way the reinforcing loops are working. That is, the communication improves, so in this reinforcing loop will then be the following. The cognitive load decreases, less improvisation, better mutual understanding, less mismatch, less errors of mismatch, less workload, less cognitive load. So now is the reinforcing loop becoming virtuous. You are now, it's going in the right direction. Similarly, the other reinforcing loop here, less workload, less cognitive load, less errors from cognitive pressure, less workload and so on. So because of the learning, the reinforcing loops will be switched on from going in the wrong direction, increasing the number of errors, creating more problems, to the other round, reducing the number of errors, improving communication, decreasing the cognitive load and so on. So this is the explanation of what is happening and the insights that we get then from our simulation model. Any questions? Now, conclusions. We have two kinds of studies on the basis of this. We have a qualitative but very detailed analysis of the landslide, its impact that it had in changing the way such disasters are prepared for and handled in Norway. And this happened about 3 to 5 years after the landslide. Then we use the interviews with the responders that we had done 9 years after the disaster, so as to get the behavior over time of crucial parameters of the disaster. For the purpose of building such system dynamic model and simulate it, we acknowledge that the data is not very complete. We acknowledge that the quality of the data is still poor, and in fact also insecure because it is based on interviews many years later. But on the other hand, if that's the best data that you have, then we can use that tentatively. Again, it's better to be approximately correct than exactly wrong. You are exactly wrong if you give all the parameters the value 0, that means you do not include them in your model. So what we can conclude is that in a sense, the explanations that the model provides with the feedback loops are quite convincing. There are things that you say, oh yes, that makes sense. Still, we say it seems to make sense, but this is a preliminary analysis. We need more studies, we need more data. So we are searching for other cases, so in order to improve our understanding. The problem is, of course, that there are not so many cases with real data, because when disasters happen, the reports that are produced, they are rarely the kind of information that we need to make models. So you have to approach the people, they have to say yes, they have to have time, and very often, as in the case of the Hartlepool landslide, they don't have really measured the values. They will tell you what they remember from memory and so on. Still, because of the model here, then you could say the following: preparing in the future for disasters, no matter which, also if they are cyber attacks or solar storms that will cause all communication to break down. We can assume that at the core, at the beginning of the problem, is the issue of adjusting the workload to a situation that's completely new. And you can prepare for that instead of doing the training so much based on given protocols and so on. You can challenge the responders' teams by giving them experience in handling in unknown situations and need to improvise. Then, of course, the question of cognitive load is also a personal thing. That's something that you can also train. For instance, among the professional sports people, they have to learn how to perform well under bike competitional stress. That's something that you can train. And of course, that's also something where you can select the people so that there are people who are less subject to stress and who are better able to perform under stress. Because avoiding errors is then very important. Then, how can you improve the mutual understanding? If you need to improvise, then you are creating new situations that the people are not conversing with. How can you improve the way this communicates? It's a question of training the people. It's also a question of technology. Then finally, how can you learn while you are working? Again, there are methods to do that so that people can orient themselves better, get a better situational awareness in new situations. So all in all, these feedback loops here give you hints as to which factors to concentrate upon if you want to prepare responders to respond well or respond better in the situations caused by disruptions, whether they are due to a cyber attack, to a landslide, to a terror attack, or you name it. So again, the conclusion is that many of the things that you are learning here, they are applicable also to other domains, and therefore, by taking the master study here, you are not only prepared to work in the setting of information security, you are getting also education that would allow also in principle to enter other kind of jobs related to disruptions, disasters and crisis, and so on and so on. So that's all for today, and then we will have two more sessions next week, and the final examination project will be early June, I think the 4th of June. It will be again be a project of 1 week's duration, and there will be also a multiple choice exam. Questions? Okay, and thank you.